me hurt, I'd like to take this chance to apologize to absolutely nobody.
Friday episode. Double Champ is back this weekend. We apologizing to nobody out here. You guys watching the fight this weekend? McGregor's back, baby. Double Champ. I'm hot on the mic right now. As you can see, I got everything I need. I got coffee. I got my water. Recycled bottle. I use it every day. Don't worry. And I got my San Pellegrino over here. I'm a San Pellegrino bitch. As you can see too, I've got a little stack of books. Tribe, behave, and the Great War for Civilization. These books are all included in the topic that I'll be talking about today, which is why I'm showcasing them here for you. I also got the full complement of the Armenian gear. What'd it do? Art sock sweater, Armenian flag, very special and rare bottle of wine from the Hadrut region. My cup from Armenia. I got some Armenian brandy, baby, and we rolling. I just came in straight from yoga. If you can see this, you know, still got sweaty hair, free balling it. Wanted to come in and knock this out. So let's get into it. This week, I'm going to update you on my 100-mile run. Probably going to leave carnivore diet behind this week, as I will be doing a full recap with my guest, Michael Rohde, on February 2nd, who's also been doing the carnivore diet alongside me. And, you know, well, I'll give you one greasy sneak peek, and that is this week for about 3 days. This morning, actually, I kind of came out of it. 3-4 days this week, my shits were just absolute pissers. I'll leave it at that. So interesting development. I'm shocked I haven't had any emergencies on my runs yet. I mean, I started running when I started the carnivore diet, so it's pretty amazing that I haven't had any emergencies, because it's like, it's not like, you know, if I had an emergency, which I did one time in Las Vegas or whatever, it's not the type of city where, like, you can't use the bathroom. Boston is the type of city, like a real city, where you can't just use the bathroom. Not a lot of bathrooms available. But let's get into it. I got a lot to cover this week. I have a lot of quotes on my... Oh, fuck me. What am I doing? Let's get into the... I'm going to recap you on my training here real quick. So 20 days into January, 26 days into the training for the 100-mile run. Covered about 100 miles total at this point. Which by the fall, I need to whittle that down from 26 days to less than 1 day. So we've got our work cut out for us. Last week, after my nonstop 14-day start, I took a day off from my activity. The following day, I did back-to-back hot yoga classes, which felt great. My vinyasa practice felt so out of whack. I did a 90-minute Bikram class, and then I followed that up with a 60-minute vinyasa. I had only taken two other yoga classes since like November 4th. My vinyasa felt out of whack. I felt weak, but I've been able to take several since then. So feeling better, feeling stronger. My chaturangas, you know, feeling good. Anyway, so from Wednesday to Sunday, then I did my plan to do the 5x5, which actually turned more into like a 5x6. I think I did 5 the first day and then 6 each of the next 4 days. So bumped my mileage up a little bit there. Monday, I went skiing in New Hampshire. I didn't run, but damn, dude, a day of skiing definitely rocked my legs, which made me feel good because I was real sore, and it was obviously working different muscle groups than the running and the yoga, or at least in a different way. So felt good. Sore is good. Means I'm getting stronger. So actually, in terms of training, I didn't feel bad about taking the day off. I kind of felt bad about taking the day off in terms of podcasting. Getting work done on that, but I'll just, it's Friday night, Friday morning. So I'll, you know, fuck it, whatever. I'll make it up. Ain't no thing but a chicken wang. Dude, yeah, something happened to me at the skiing thing that I'm just not sure how I feel about it. At one point during the day, about midway through, a couple of the guys that I was with were going off this little jump that we had found in these trees. And it was like, not a jump, but it was more like a little cliff thing, a little drop off. And it was definitely something where any time in my life, whether or not I could do it or not, I would freaking go for it, you know? And I just chose not to do it that day. I chose not to attempt the jump. And it was a conscious decision by me not to make the jump and risk hurting myself. You know, because that would kind of derail my goals and everything I've got planned for the year. But I just remember standing there when these dudes were about to jump and like thinking to myself, why am I not doing this jump? This is not like me to not be doing this jump. And I actually remember like almost taking the first step back up the mountain to do this, because I was like, fuck it, dude, that's not me to sit this out. I'm always like skiing in particular, I don't know what it is about skiing, I always pretend to be better than I am. Maybe I should do that with podcasting too. And just go for it, you know, and don't really worry about the risk of getting hurt or anything. And just not doing it. I'm not sure. I don't know. So it's like, I can't remember too many times in my life, spit it out already. I can't remember too many times in my life that I chose not to do something because I was worried about getting hurt, or like I've got a bigger goal that I want to achieve, you know, a bigger goal than to prove I can be wild and jump off this little cliff edge and show the boys, like, you know, I'm willing to send it, as they say in the world of skiing. I don't know what was the right decision for me, because I wonder if a part of me dies when I don't do something like this, like a part of me dies if I don't partake in such activities, or on the flip side, if a new part of me is born by, you know, making that decision not to, recognizing the risks involved and weighing it against my loftier goals and choosing not to do it. But obviously that's the more positive view to take, is that it's a sign of growth. But I can't remember many situations in my life where I did that, and it makes me feel a bit uncomfortable. But yeah, I want to run the 100 miles this year, but I still want to rip life. So anyway, Tuesday I got back on the run, 4 miles. Wednesday I did hot yoga, ran 6. Thursday I did another 6. Today I got back from yoga, and I'll do another 6. Tomorrow I'll do the exact same thing, yoga and 6. And if I do 6 miles the rest of the month, I'll get to 150 for January. I like that. It means I have to average 6 miles a day. I think I just said that. It's doable. I just hope it's not too much, because last time I picked up running, it was a much slower start for me. Get the fuck out of here. Kevin, don't call me right now. Doing a podcast. So yeah, last time I picked up running, it was much slower start. 30 miles or so in November, 115-ish in December, and then 250 in January 2020. Which that 250 in that 250 includes my 51 mile run. So a lot going on there, but 150 is a bit of a quicker start. Obviously it's much colder in Boston than Las Vegas as well, so you kind of have to deal with that on the knees and everything. As I've mentioned plenty of times before, I'm just not in as good a shape as I was picking it up last time. Finally built up a schedule around my work and found like 3 yoga classes during the week that I can build blocks into my schedule. Which will allow me to develop my training schedule for February. My goal in February is to up it to 175. I was considering going all the way up to 250 or even 200, but I was kind of like looking at what that involved, and it's not, I don't need to do that yet. So I'm going to do another month, 175, not get ahead of myself, keep building myself up the way I should. You know, I expect to come into February a little bit tired from kind of pushing myself over these last, like what will be about 13 days or so to close out January and get to that 150. But then I'll kind of ramp it up at the end of February. So I'll be doing longer runs, more compressed. There's three less days. And if all goes well, I think let me just take a chew it over with a coffee here. Mississippi mud. So I think March will be the month I'll push it up to that 250. I also plan to run my first marathon distance in February. Too early to do it in January. I could do it if I wanted to, but again, all bigger goals. Because a side goal of mine last year was to do 12 marathon distance plus 12 marathon plus distances in 2020. I think I was up to about 7 before I got hurt. So might as well come back for that. And I don't think I'll have a problem if I actually see this thing through the end, training for the 100. I don't see that being an obstacle in my way. It'll just be a natural part of the training, I think. But my mind is feeling great. My ankle should be a non-factor, although it definitely makes itself, makes its presence known to me on the daily. I don't think it's going to be an issue though. But my knees are the wild card here. I mean, they're the sore bits and the throbbers when I come back. So hopefully these feelings are just a reacclimation to the pavement and the time spent on my feet. And, you know, we're just killing it. Keep you updated throughout the process. So I will give you, I'll give you another update next week, because next Friday, I believe, will be pretty damn close to the end of the month here, and I should have a training schedule for February and shit like that. And I'll also be coming off the diet, which would be fun. Oh god, dude, I don't know. Let's just say this: come Monday, February 1st, if I was a sugary snack like a donut, I'd be worried, because I'm coming for you. All right, let's get into this week's topic. And switching gears for sure. I've already been going for 13 minutes here. Holy shit, I got a lot to get through here. Well, let's get it going. I'm gonna slap you with a quote. There's a lot of quotes in here. About 80% of them or so are from this book called Tribe on Homecoming, and I'll get into it, obviously. And then a couple of the quotes are from these other books. Just wanted to throw that out. I'll be doing, you know, a decent amount of reading from the quotes, and want to make sure that like a good chunk of this work comes from these books. It's stuff that I'm interested in. I don't know if I'm contributing a whole lot, but anyway, let's get into it. Here's a quote. "We were the happiest and we laughed more." Nedzara Ahmedasavic, a survivor of the Bosnian War, which rocked her hometown of Sarajevo in the early 1990s, made this comment 20 years later in an interview with Sebastian Younger. He's an author and journalist. If you know of his documentary, which was on Netflix for quite a while in the early 2010s, it was called Restrepo, where he spent some time in Afghanistan with this U.S. military group in Afghanistan. It's not the part of the book. Just throwing it out there. Nedzara was 17 when the war broke out, and her comments are a reflection on what she misses the most about the war. "We were the happiest, and we laughed more." Younger's work in Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging and Ahmedasavic's comments are the inspirations for this week's episode, so let's dive in. I first read Tribe back in 2017. Since then, I've read it 3 more times, largely because of Nedzara's comments struck me in just a really profound way. I just thought it was something just sat with me. I always thought it was interesting that she said some of these things that she said. "We were the happiest during war, and we laughed more when like their friends were dying, their family were dying, they were under attack, they were under siege." Like, I just always wondered why. Because war can be so nasty and horrible. It showcases the most disgusting, barbaric capabilities of human beings. The tragedy that results from war is unequivocal in pretty much any form. But war can bring out some of the more beautiful and selfless tendencies in human beings as well. And it's the psychological effects that these wars or different tragedies and disasters have on civilians that I'm interested in on this episode. So what is it about the adversity and the hardships that innately I'm interested in what is it about the adversity and the hardships that innately unites us in such powerful ways? What is it about our in-groups or our us that creates the space for such passion and social bonds formed during these particularly hard times? The in-group is like any time you identify as something, your in-group is part of that group. So your us. And that can obviously be a range of about an infinite amount of things that whatever you identify, and it can be something very broad, like Christian, Muslim, whatever, human, alien, could be whatever. So I'll give you a brief history here about the Bosnian War. The Bosnian War, it's a classic tale of arbitrary lines being drawn in the sand by the winners of the world wars, making life miserable for basically everyone involved in the land drawing map countries. See also Middle East if you need another example of how that goes. So the Bosnian War involves several different cultures: the Bosniaks, which are Bosnian Muslims, Serbs, and Croatians. Not the Kreutz. Or what are they called, German people? Krauts, not the Krauts. And so it also involved a change from a socialist government to a communist rule, I believe, was kind of like going on at the time. Estimates are 100,000 to 200,000 people were killed from 1992 to 1995 in the Balkans due to the conflict. And this is what Nidzar lived through and speaks of in her comments to Sebastian Younger in his book Tribe. So why was she happiest during those seemingly miserable years? And what about turmoil and death would make a 17-year-old girl and her friends laugh more? Younger writes, and I have combined two quotes here, "Adversity often leads people to depend more on one another. Self-interest gets subsumed into group interest because there is no survival outside group survival." Now, I was only 8 years old when the Twin Towers fell in New York City. I was in third grade. But I remember watching it on TV in the classroom, like, you know, classic freaking TV that they would roll in on the big ass carts back in elementary school. They rolled it in. Normally for a third grader, that would mean like party day and movie. But this day it meant, you know, tragedy. Although I don't really remember that day besides being in class and kind of watching it on TV and hearing the announcer or the whatever fucking secretary or principal coming on the loudspeaker. I don't know. The period in our country's history when everyone was on the same side and there was so much unification in our nation that followed that is something that you hear people talk about all the time. So it's like, why? Because what I don't know, I was young at the time. I don't know any internal differences that we had as the American people. We came together to help one another, to support each other, just like, oh, we're together, fuck them. Partly, maybe, possibly, thanks to Toby Keith and his magical country music hymns, but I don't know. I think he may have played a factor in our unity. Well, put a boot in your ass. That's the amount. So an out-group or a them attacked our nation, our us. No matter our internal differences, for a period of time following 9/11, put them aside. We looked out for us, our in-group. And from what I see, hear, read, it was a pleasant time to be American. So much love, support for our fellow countrymen. Side note, I just recently found out about this maybe 2 years ago. Have you ever heard of the Manhattan boat rescue that took place that day? It's pretty fucking incredible, actually. It was the largest maritime boat rescue or evacuation in history. ferry boats, fishing boats, tour boats, private boats, probably some fucking dude in a kayak, like all hands on deck, getting people out of Manhattan the day when the towers fell. I think they evacuated 500, a half a million people on the boats from Manhattan the day that the towers fell. And just for a comparison, I looked this up. Operation Dynamo, which is the famous evacuation at Dunkirk, transported 338,000 people to safety. So 500,000 people that day. Very, very cool. It's just amazing what the level of group cooperation we're capable of achieving when our backs are against the wall. Adversity unites. Dipping our toes into a little bit of science, might as well. Scientifically, this group cooperation can be partly explained by oxytocin, which is a hormone/neurotransmitter that some of you may know as the love drug, because it's important role in human behaviors such as trust, anxiety, mother-infant bonding is probably the most famous, and sexual arousal. Ooh, just talking about it. Talking about oxytocin gets me aroused. And you're probably wondering who the hell gets sexually aroused by maritime evacuations. And that would be me. And Floridians, probably. But the real important factor here is in Younger's words, which he says again here. Group cooperation triggers higher levels of oxytocin, for example, which promotes everything from breastfeeding in women to higher levels of trust and group bonding in men. Both reactions impart a powerful sensation of well-being. Oxytocin creates a feedback loop of good feeling and group loyalty that ultimately leads members to self-sacrifice to promote group welfare. End quote. So it's this self-sacrifice to promote growth. This self-sacrifice to promote growth. Damn it. Oh, shit. It's... Fuck! The self-sacrifice to promote group welfare is exactly what we saw in the aftermath of 9/11. And I imagine our country was just oozing oxytocin during World War II because, like, you know, these people were strapped and ready to go whatever they needed to do, World War II. Good for them. Glad we won both. Not a trilogy fight I want to see. So 2-0, you don't really leave the door open for one. You push us into a corner, we're going to bond, we're going to, you know, sacrifice, put aside our differences, our self-interest for the survival of the group, which is our group, which is our nation. But what about them? I think this is actually more interesting about oxytocin, because you always hear people saying, like, yeah, like I said before, oxytocin's the love drug. It's in all this bonding. It makes people love each other. But oxytocin's got a special surprise for you. According to a study conducted by Karsten de Drew of the University of Amsterdam, which I discovered in primatologist Robert Sapolsky's book, Behave, which I've mentioned before on this podcast, says that while oxytocin helps facilitate intense pro-social bonding among our in-groups, it actually makes humans more ethnocentric and xenophobic towards thems or out-groups. So oxytocin can cause us to act more aggressively against out-groups. Imagine a place like the Middle East, or more specifically, the West Bank, where you're born into a chaotic world. From the moment you're born, you already have issues with your neighbors, you know, drinking milk from your mother, oxytocin, love, bond. You learn about your people's history and persecution and dispossession. And again, oxytocin against the thems. You learn about the group of people responsible for these acts against your people and more oxytocin. You love yours, you hate them, oxytocin, pumping. And I think just like that, I solved the problem of West Bank and the Middle East by boiling down the problem to one powerful hormone, oxytocin. That's my TED Talk. Thanks for coming. But I'm more interested, what about these tragedies is it that ignites people's will to help one another, to sacrifice their time, their energy, resources, possibly life, in order to serve their community? H.A. Lyons found that social bonds were reinforced during disasters and that people overwhelmingly devoted their energies toward the good of the community rather than just themselves. He says, When people are more actively engaged in a cause, their lives have more purpose. 100%, no doubt. I agree with that all day. With a resulting improvement in mental health. Again, all on board with that. Lyons published these thoughts in a paper published in the Journal of Psychosomatic Research in 1979. And Younger references Lyons' work in his book, Tribe. It really makes sense to me at every level. You know, when I have a goal or something to strive for, or a cause to contribute to, my life is better. I feel better. My mental health is better. Just all around clicking better when I have a purpose or a goal or contributing to something. I'm more driven. And the first time I think I truly understood how good it feels to be engaged in a cause that benefits others was on a volunteer trip that I took to the Florida Keys in November 2017 after Hurricane Irma blasted them. I was there with a disaster relief organization, All Hands and Hearts. They actually were called All Hands when I first got there, and they adopted the new name, All Hands and Hearts, while I was with them on my first stint. But giving weeks of my life as a volunteer to help strangers over 1,000 miles away from home with other like-minded people just really opened my eyes to the value of giving, sharing, sacrificing my time, resources, things like that. Had a just insanely powerful effect on me. In the following year, I went back and spent 5 more weeks with All Hands in the Virgin Islands. And I know what you're probably thinking, but I don't fucking pick where the hurricanes hit, all right? So, but if the beach is calling, not a bad side effect. And I haven't been able to join them again since 2018, which is tough because I really love them. I'd love to go back. 2019 didn't happen. 2020, not possible, really. So I don't know what my future holds in that space, thanks to COVID, but I learned many valuable lessons that I've been able to apply to my everyday life and shit that really changed me to my core, which is the value of just sharing my time and my resources and how good it helps to feel others and share with others, things like that, because I think I'm a pretty naturally selfish person in a lot of ways. And it's just something that I'm, you know, realizing in my older life, like, how can I be myself still and use my selfishness to help me out when I need to? And then, but also just like, where are areas of my life that I can be more generous? So that was really a cool eye opener for me. In terms of mental health, like, vibrancy and authenticity, I just felt at my best when I was on those projects. Physically, both times I wasn't in great health. I was I was still having quite a bit of fun. But just overall, like, how good you feel in your spirit is just so cool. And back to Younger, another quote here, he says, the 3 pillars of self-determination are autonomy, competence, and community. We need to feel competent at what we do. That's where our, you know, you want to feel good at what you do, because, like, well, I don't know. Hell, if I felt good at doing a pod, if I actually felt like I was good at doing the podcast, my podcast would probably be much better. And we're getting there. If I felt competent, Three pillars of self-determination are autonomy, competence, and community. We need to feel competent at what we do. We need to feel authentic in our lives, and we need to feel connected to others. Whether it's war or a Category 5 hurricane, disaster and tragedy have a special way of bringing people together. They create opportunity for everyone in a community to exhibit some level of each of these 3 pillars, helping out in any way possible, being competent, being surrounded by others, working to achieve the same goals, whether that's sewing sleeping bags for soldiers on the front line, or gutting someone's rotten house after being smashed by another hurricane. Connection to others, feeling authentic because you truly believe in what you're working to achieve, defending your homeland, rebuilding your community. People will feel better psychologically if they have more involvement with their community, Younger writes on page 49. And I think that's something that can be taken extremely broadly just to everyday life. Like, go to a community, you know, type in, I don't know, Google highest unemployment rates in the US, find like the top 50 counties with the highest unemployment rates, and then check what their crime rates look like. Check how many, check what their, you know, depression looks like, or their drug use, alcohol use. See what those levels are. And then find places in the U.S. that have the lowest unemployment rate and do the same test. And I imagine you're going to find that more people with jobs feeling like they're contributing to their community are just going to be all around a more psychologically healthy community. But that's just, I don't know. It seems like it would make sense to me. But my Google is pretty slow right now, so you're going to have to do that on your own. Back to the Bosnian War. During the Bosnian War and the siege on Sarajevo, Nizara, she actually was injured when an artillery round hit her parents' fucking house, filled her leg full of shrapnel. She was real banged up. They took her, this is all in the book, they took her to the hospital. They performed reconstructive surgery on her leg without anesthesia. And this is her quote. She says, "They hold you down and you scream, and that helps," were her words. But despite these traumatic events, her people were the happiest and they laughed more. You know, this is what always just keeps coming back. In her apartment complex, there was about 60 families that all lived together, and these families shared everything. They all gathered water together. They all tended a garden together. They shared their appliances and their space. One time, there's a story in the book, a neighbor gave Nizara a single egg on her 18th birthday. And she wanted to share. So, like, you know, one egg doesn't go real far in sharing, but this genius of a girl decided to make pancakes for her friends. And one egg can go, you know, a little bit further if you make pancakes. So no doubt they were the most splendid stack of cakes, you know, ever made. Most splendid stack of cakes ever made. This next section of the book, I'm actually going to read directly from the book because it's pretty cool. The basement of one of the buildings was deep enough to serve as a bomb shelter. Teenagers from the neighborhood led a kind of communal life down there, separate from the adults above ground. The boys would go off to the front line for 10 days at a stretch and then return to join the girls. What a life. Who lived down there full time? Everyone slept on mattresses on the floor together and ate their meals together and fell in and out of love together and played music and talked about literature and joked about the war. The boys were like our brothers, Amidazovic said. It's not like we were girls waiting for them and crying. No, we had a party. To be honest, it was kind of liberation. To love, the love that we shared was enormous. They'd come back from the front lines. Most of them were musicians, and they would have small concerts for us. We didn't believe in heroes. We were punk rockers. Our biggest hero was David Bowie. Pretty remarkable statement, I think, right there, that ultimately led me all the way to Armenia in November of last year, 2020, when the war broke out between Armenia and Azerbaijan. It's like, this book was crazy to me ever since I first read it, and I wanted to experience with my own presence something similar to what these teenagers experienced and try to figure out what it is, you know, what it is about shared hardship that just brings the best out of people. And why, as Younger puts it, humans are so strongly wired to help one another and enjoy such enormous social benefits from doing so, that people will regularly risk their lives for complete strangers. I wanted to see it for myself. Ultimately, the war in Artsakh ended just a few days before I arrived in Yerevan, the capital city of Armenia. But there's nothing cut and dry about a peace agreement or the end of a war. It's not something you just sign the agreement, wipe your hands, walk away. Everything's peaceful. It's still war after all, and the emotions are still running high, and there's a lot still going on. But granted, there was one major difference between Sarajevo in the 90s, where Nizara was living through, and Yerevan in 2020. Sarajevo was under siege, while Yerevan was far away from the battlefield. But war is still the same, people under attack, fighting for their homeland, doing what they can to contribute to the success of their group survival. Though their country and homeland is under attack, the group of people I met in Armenia, they didn't have to worry about an artillery shell bursting through the wall of their apartments. You know what I mean? Compared to, like, it's this, I mean, it's different, but it's still the same. It's still war. It's still their country. Just a little bit different when the action's not at your front door. I actually met them on my first night in Armenia. I was fortunate enough to attend a gathering with some local Armenians and some American-born Armenian diaspora, through a friend of a friend, which pretty cool. So maybe I've told this story, but I'll just quickly recap. I was starting to teach yoga here in Boston. I told Shelly that I was not going to be able to teach for about 5 weeks because I was going to be on the road. She asked what I was doing. I told her what I was doing. She was like, I got a friend back in California that has contacts in Armenia. I'll hit her up, see if she's got anyone over there. She put me in contact with Narek, and it was him who I stayed with for my first 3 to 4 days, I think, in Armenia. Hung out with like his friend group. That's where I met everyone. And so, yeah, so I head up. Pretty cool, just connections. So the war ended just 4 days prior, and only the previous day when I showed up, four of them were able to travel to Artsakh in order to help kind of clear an ancient monastery of its articles and just try to preserve it, because it was sitting on a chunk of land that was to be handed over in the newly signed peace agreement, unfortunately, which means that it'll probably be vandalized, if not destroyed entirely. But very cool experience for them to be able to go and contribute that way. And that was not like a coincidence or a stroke of luck for these guys to be able to do that. They've actually, they put in a fuck ton of work and have done a really great job throughout the entire war and post-war, helping families and soldiers as well, and also the country by doing things like cleaning out the church. But on that night, it was so cool. We were drinking wine. I got there at like 10 o'clock at night, drinking wine. There was music, dancing. It was just like I read in the book. Like they get together like every night, a group of young people. They spend their entire days contributing to the war effort, preserving history, like I said, raising money, meeting families, putting their lives on hold, whatever goals they had. They've got real life jobs, giving their time for the betterment of their country, their group survival. Their people's very existence is under attack. Once again, if you're not familiar with the Armenian genocide carried out by the Ottoman Empire / Turks, the Turkish people in the early 1900s, give it a quick Google. It was the first genocide of the 20th century. A little bit of a trailblazing cause there. It was a Holocaust before the Holocaust. It was the systematic rounding up, expulsion, murder, massacre of Armenian people in what is now mostly in modern day Turkey. And that's kind of where the diaspora come from Armenia. They just kind of had to scatter at that point. So yeah, they're sacrificing their self-interest for the interests of the group survival. And at night they drink together to decompress, I suppose, plan more ways in which they can help, lean on each other for support. Very cool situation. Sebastian Younger notes that adversity often leads people to depend more on one another, and that closeness can produce a kind of nostalgia for the hard times that even some civilians are susceptible to. And I'll probably turn this into a blog post, FYI, if you're interested. I did send out some questions to a few of them that I met to see if they would answer me on that subject, kind of. Haven't heard back, but I did want to do the podcast. I can throw them in to the blog post and it'll be groovy. But before I get too far down the road here, I want to make clear that I'm not romanticizing war. I'm not trying to glorify war and the atrocities that kind of come with it. But, you know, real people die, real family members never come back for the party in the bomb shelter basement. Real people give their lives protecting their us, ensuring the group survival. The bonds are powerful. And Nizar makes another comment on page 67 on this matter. She says, no matter what I say about war, I still hate it. And Tribe, Sebastian Younger, offers this question / statement to his readers to ponder. Maybe not. Maybe I just like to ponder it. But He says, what would you risk dying for and for whom is perhaps the most profound question a person can ask themselves. The vast majority of people in modern society are able to pass their whole lives without ever having to answer that question. And this could mean jumping in front of a bus to save a child while giving up your own life, or it could mean going to war to fight for your homeland. I'm lucky, personally, I consider myself lucky to live in America, which we have a powerful military, a non-compulsory military, a military that hasn't seen action on its own soil since the 1890s. I consider myself fortunate that it's a question that's more theoretical than applied. It's definitely something to consider thinking about, just to see where you stand on some things. But here's a crazy fucking example. And this is from the book, The Great War for Civilization by Robert Fisk, that I'm reading at the moment. But consider this. If I were an adolescent boy, 13, 14 years old, living in Iran in the early 1980s, in the early 1980s, I would have been asked or told to ride my motorcycle into the battlefield ahead of advancing forces in order to clear the area of landmines. And I would have happily obliged, because martyrdom, and this is a quote here, martyrdom is the highest point in human life. And another quote, when the first drop of martyr's blood is spilt, all his sins are cleansed. Can you fucking imagine being let down if you don't get to be on your motorcycle riding through the battlefield hoping to hit a landmine? To be a martyr, to die for whatever, your religion or your country of Iran. And man, it's just a crazy, crazy thing to consider, that this is like, martyrdom is a huge, huge, man, it's a wild subject. And it gets really interesting when you start looking at the, like, Israel, the West Bank, Gaza in the late 90s, early 2000s, how much martyrdom was carried out over there. It's wild. People, that area, it's a crazy place to live. Pretty lucky to not have to do that. But another comment by Nadzara Medazavik. She had to say this 20 years after the siege of Sarajevo again in her interview with Younger. She said, we didn't learn the lesson of the war, which is how important it is to share everything you have with human beings close to you. Best way to explain it is that war makes you an animal. We were animals. But that's basic human instinct, to help another person. Let's get the quote right. To help another human being who is sitting or standing or lying close to you. And man, I don't know. I read that book for the first time in 2017. I read it a couple more times. It literally drugged my ass all the way across the world. I wanted to find out and see for myself. I want to do it again. I want to do it in another area. I want to do it differently. But I just find it fascinating. And it's cool how similar, like, okay, you've got war, that's one thing, and it brings these people together in such a crazy way, and almost like they long for the nostalgia, kind of the way that we think back on 9/11, which is not war, but it's, you know, a terrible act that killed a lot of people, and our country, like, you know, our population came together because of it. You get communities that get rocked, and you see this all the time. You see communities that get rocked by disasters and how people come together to help each other, support each other through the tough times. I just find it completely fascinating. It's a topic that I'm interested in. It's a topic that I'll continue to explore more throughout my life. And that's about all I got for you. Let's make my prediction for the fight this weekend. I'm going McGregor KO. Next fight is a title shot. And I hope he gets another crack at Khabib, because, you know, as a former athlete myself and competitor, like, I understand that people have bad days, people overlook people when they shouldn't, they don't train, their priorities get a little bit jumbled up. And I feel like Conor McGregor really wants Khabib back. I feel like he let that one slip, and I don't think Khabib wants that smoke. So bada bing, bada boom, bitches. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I think it's a cool little topic. Looking forward to next week's episode, which I have no idea what I'm going to talk about then. Definitely. Fuck it. Have a good weekend, everybody. Peace.